Welcome to this session of the Futures Foundation Futures Forum. I'll introduce our guest in a moment, but first allow me to outline what will happen. Those of us physically present, thanks to the good graces of Steve Shepherd from Randstad, will listen to our guest for about 45 minutes. This will be audio recorded. After he finishes, we'll turn off the recorder and have a conversation amongst ourselves. I hope those of you listening to a podcast will also take the opportunity to talk about the ideas presented today, because that's what these forums are all about, actively creating a better Australia. Our guest today is the recently re-elected federal member for the seat of Melbourne, Adam Bandt. Adam was until recently the deputy leader of the Greens and increased his margin at the most recent election. Prior to becoming a parliamentarian, Adam studied and practised as a lawyer, and he has a PhD from Monash University in both law and politics. And so he's well versed, both by his previous studies and his current practice, to talk about our theme, which is the role of the federal government in creating Australia's future. Welcome. Thanks for coming, Adam.
Look, thanks very much for having me. Thanks to Steve and to Randstad for hosting us. And I want to acknowledge the traditional owners of the land and pay respects to their elders past and present. And I'm glad to be here discussing this with you, the role of government in creating Australia's future rather than in Parliament, because in Parliament it's actually quite difficult to generate any sensible debate about the future. To take one issue as a point of departure, the government said we had a budget emergency, and the Prime Minister said in February of this year, and I quote, "What's fair about saddling our children and our grandchildren with debt and deficit as far as the eye can see? This is intergenerational theft. This generation of Australians is blighting the lives of our children and grandchildren because we, under the former Labor government, lacked the intestinal fortitude to address these issues. We absolutely owe it to the Australian people and the Australian people of the future to tackle this issue." I think it was Edmund Burke who talked about the social compact as being a kind of trust between those who are dead, those who are living, and those who are yet to be born. "We will not break the trust." That's the end of his quote. Now, this concern, I suggest, was in many ways was more than a little feigned, for barely 7 months later, it seems we are awash with cash and can now afford tax cuts right here and right now. But let's think about the Prime Minister's quote about future generations a bit more. Edmund Burke's social compact was more than a mere commercial contract. It was, to continue in Burke's words this time, and I quote, "a partnership in all science, a partnership in all art, a partnership in every virtue and in all perfection. As the ends of such a partnership cannot be obtained in many generations, it becomes a partnership not only between those who are living, but between those who are living, those who are dead, and those who are to be born." End of quote. But if it really is a partnership in all science that we have with future generations, why don't we think the same way about climate change as we do about debt? Let me read you another comment from our future-focused Treasurer. Joe Hockey said, in a quote, "Budget repair is also about ensuring that future generations do not pay for a standard of living for today's generation that they themselves will never enjoy. Continued deficit and debt is borrowing from tomorrow to fund our lifestyle today. We owe it to our children not to leave them with a mortgage that paid for our lifestyle." Now, I want to suggest what a wonderful thing this quote would be if budget was replaced with climate and deficit and debt with pollution. Instead, our government is intent on tearing down meaningful action on climate change. But there's a deeper problem here. What manner of thinking is it that can talk this way about the budget of a country whose finances are reasonably strong, yet not about the conditions of life upon which we all depend? And internationally, why is it that governments can show what is possible when the banking system is in trouble and trillions are found within weeks to stem a crisis, and yet international climate negotiations drag on for decades without a result? More bluntly, why isn't life at least as important as money when governments talk about the future? And this, for me, is one of the most pressing problems in politics today, because climate change brings the problem of the future right into the present, but in a way that we seem to have no political vocabulary to deal with. And at the very time that we need to take urgent steps to preserve the conditions of life for now and the future, we struggle to treat life with the same respect as the budget. And the problem is indeed pressing. A lot is spoken about climate change, not necessarily by our government, but by many others. And it's worth just pausing to note the significant time that we find ourselves in history. People talk about whether you can warm the planet or not, and there's a general acceptance that 2 degrees is the limit beyond which we can't warm it. But the planet's not like this room, where you can turn a thermostat up or down and regulate the temperature with a fair degree of accuracy and responsiveness. The better analogy is with the human body, where you have a band within which the body can exist, and you know that you don't want to get the body too much outside of that band, because the doctor may not be able to advise you exactly which organ is going to fail or at exactly which time the patient is going to die, but they can tell you you're entering a high degree of risk, and so you want to stay within that band. And it's the same for the climate. We have this band, and the scientists have called it essentially a two degree guardrail. Now, the problem that we've got is that since the beginning of the industrial era, we've heated the planet by about 0.85 of a degree. And even if we turned off every source of pollution tomorrow, even if we plugged every chimney and stopped burning every bit of fossil fuel tomorrow, lags in the climate system mean that there's probably around about 0.7 degrees of warming locked in. So in other words, even if we stopped everything tomorrow, our planet is probably going to be about 1.5 degrees warmer on average than at the start of the industrial era. And that finds itself, as I said, not by just slightly turning the thermostat up by 1.5 degrees, but by fundamentally changing some of the systems on which our life depends. So we've now got this little half a degree window left. And how do we stay within that half a degree window? One of the things we can think about is in terms of a carbon budget that we've got left for the planet to burn. And what we're told is that if you want a better than even chance of staying below the 2 degree guardrail, and the reason it's a guardrail is that beyond that point, scientists are telling us that runaway climate change becomes more likely than not, and you have feedback loops kicking in that might not be able to be stopped. So, for example, if you think about the sun coming down onto the poles at the moment, one of the things that the white space of the Arctic does is reflect some sun back up, but of course the more dark space there is, so the more the ice recedes, the more that there is the sea that absorbs the heat, and therefore the warming continues, and the sea becomes warmer and it melts the ice more quickly, and the feedback loops kick in. It's those kind of feedback loops that scientists are worried about if we get above 2 degrees. And they've told us that it's just simple mathematics, really. We've got 565 more gigatons of carbon that we can of carbon dioxide that we can emit to stay below 2 degrees of warming. And anything more than that poses substantial risk. The problem is that burning the fossil fuel that's now in reserve would emit 5 times that amount. So in other words, 2,795 gigatons is what's there sitting in the ground or in reserve at the moment. And we're up, so we've got 565 gigatons left, and annual emissions are up around 40 gigatons a year and rising at the moment. So we've got 10 to 15 years of business as usual left, and we've got 5 times as much as we're allowed to burn currently sitting in the ground. So it seems like a simple mathematical proposition. Problem is, we are running up against business models that are premised on digging that up and burning it as quickly as possible. And we have other business models that aren't premised on that, but they're not yet in the ascendancy. And the ones that are premised on undermining the conditions of life have enormous sway. And it's especially so here in Australia, and this is why I'll come back to the important role of the government for the future of Australia and for the planet. in the Galilee Basin, and there's been some discussion about this recently, in the Galilee Basin, the if the all the coal there is dug up and burnt, we will be, from that coal, burning over, producing over 700 million tonnes of carbon per annum. That compares to Australia's 534 million at the moment. So in other words, we'll, more than Australia will be burnt and produced as a result of the Galilee Basin alone. The coal from the Galilee Basin alone would take up 6% of that remaining carbon budget that we've got, that 500-odd gigatons we've got, just in one state, in one country, 6% of our whole budget that we've got left. So it's got significance for Australia because of the business model, but it's also got enormous significance for Australia because of the way that we produce our energy domestically. Now, essentially, we've got an electricity network that's a series of copper lines out to coal mines. And that wasn't developed that way because a cabal of evil people sat around and said, how can we most pollute the planet and stuff up the world? It's just the way that it was done. And people thought back then that you could continue to dig things up and burn them with impunity. And as a result, 3/4 of our electricity in Australia comes from coal, from digging up and burning it. And when you think about the other technological developments that have taken place in the world since then, the fact over the last 100 to 200 years, the fact that we are still producing electricity by digging up coal and boiling water hundreds of kilometres away and then turning that into a form of electricity that loses an enormous amount as it's transmitted over those hundreds of kilometres is really astounding. But nonetheless, that's what we do. And then the scientists come in with a bit more great news and tell us that for Australia to bear its share of this global burden and this global challenge, we effectively need to become a zero pollution society within the next decade or two at the most. So when you think about the legacy systems that we are left with in our energy system at the moment, and you think about the size of the challenge that we've got, it's an enormous challenge. This, I would argue, is what government must be for. Government, in my view, must be the midwife of a clean energy society. Government must foster the creativity that will bring this society about, but it must also be prepared to regulate and fund the transition. But sadly, I'll come back here to some of the quotes from the beginning, climate change has arrived at the wrong time, to be a bit glib about it. If climate change had arrived in the 1930s, perhaps governments might be talking about this as a bold new deal that could be struck to get people to work and address the challenges that we've got, or if it arrived in the 50s, it might be viewed through the lens of post-war reconstruction and all shoulders to the wheel to get ourselves back on track. But instead, it arrives at a time when the relationship between the economy and society now sees the latter made to work in the interests of the former rather than the other way around. And as a result, politics no longer inspires, and the space for discussions about long-term plans for the future is almost non-existent. And I want to talk a little bit about why this is the case so that we can then begin to think about how to break out of this straitjacket and advocate for a more pivotal role for government in Australia's future and for government being the midwife of the clean energy society. Sort of backtrack a moment though. In Australia, economic rationalism came to the party sort of a little later than elsewhere, but when it arrived, it enjoyed the fervent backing of Labor and Liberal in the 1980s. And I think people would generally be aware of the economic aspects of this. It's sometimes also called neoliberalism, but usually something like economic rationalism. And those aspects are price signals governing economic activities, the removal of tariffs, floating exchange rates, privatisation. All of those things have been extensively canvassed and talked about by commentators, as has the third way embrace of these principles by social democratic parties. But I think what serves more attention then the economics of it is the political consequences of this shift and what it means for the Australian body politic. The usual progressive critique of privatisation is that it's handing over to the wealthy of assets and values that have been created by the public over many years, and argue that when the profit motive is inserted into the provision of essential services, prices go up, and the public is forced to pay a second time for the private sector to profit for something the public itself paid for in the first place. And it's also true that a different relationship is instilled between the service and the people it's meant to serve. And so people on public transport cease to be passengers who want a safe and reliable way of getting around and are now customers urged to maximise their travelling experience. All of this, I think, people know and have heard the arguments about that have been played out over over many decades. But I think there's something more interesting to say. Because after all, in many respects, that's what classical liberalism did. It said people should satisfy their needs in the realm of the market, and that in turn saw classic liberalism met with the social movements of the late 19th and early 20th century that brought about some pretty deep and lasting critiques of the unfairness of that system. And so we had the big rise of the welfare state coming after that. But I want to suggest that what's neo about neoliberalism is a reshaping of the way people are meant to conduct themselves as the political world is changed around them. And I think, in the nutshell, I think people are no longer consumers, they're also turned into competitors. And I think, so if you think about in Australia at the moment, for example, someone who's reaching voting age this year will have grown up being told that higher education is a commodity which they'll have to pay for through debt. They'll have a choice between a variety of electricity retailers, and they'll face penalties if they don't take out private health insurance when they start working. So government forces people to participate in a market. And people are then forced to think about themselves as competitors, but also, I think, to think about the fundamentals of their own lives in terms of the entrepreneur or the speculator. Should you make decisions now to invest in yourself by going to university, for example, hedging future pay rises against future debt? I'm not here, and this isn't a speech against innovation and entrepreneurialism, far from it, as you'll see when I get towards the end. The point that I want to make, and this comes back to Tony Abbott and his point about compacts with future generations, is that making people behave as competitors and entrepreneurs in their private lives isn't what the classic liberals and conservatives had in mind. They wanted entrepreneurialism to have pride of place in economics. The market was where you satisfied your needs through business operating according to the profit motive, but there always remained a separate place for conducting your family or your personal life or educating yourself. And recall Edmund Burke's quote that I talked about at the start. If you read on from what Tony Abbott was talking about, he talked about unfinished projects of art, science and thinking. So in other words, government had a role in maintaining, or at least letting be, a good society, not just an economy. And that was always something that conservatives and liberals took seriously. And now, as I've just outlined, the ground rules are changing. And I think the consequences of this for politics and for government thinking about the future are very profound. Firstly, as the government pulls back, and let's go through a few of them. Firstly, as the government pulls back from directly providing services, people gradually find it less rational to imagine a future role for government in these areas. So for an 18-year-old who's never known a government-owned bank, renationalisation is unlikely to be a big priority come election time. You're not going to win that many votes by talking about it, even if, whether you think it's a good idea or not. And on this front, I think it's no wonder that the Labor Party finds itself in such a pickle when it struggles to explain what it stands for. So many of these things that made enormous sense 100 years ago now make no sense to someone who's grown up in a very different world. And secondly, and this is what I'm especially interested in as we start to think about how government can create a transition plan for a clean economy, as what was once in common is now private, politics is decreasingly seen as a place to connect or reconnect with each other. So some of the big political questions that we've grappled with as a species over the years have traditionally relied on an understanding that there is a commons, a place of shared ownership of something, whether it's resources or wealth or air or water or energy production. And so the arguments were about how best to deal... So arguments about how best to deal with the commons were fair game in political debate. It's what characterised political debate for much of the 20th century. But as people are asked to meet their needs and think about their lives solely in market terms, public discussion about the commons recedes. And I'll come back to this point again towards the end. And thirdly, instead of the small state of classical liberalism, we now have a very strong state of, under economic rationalism. And just because the government has taken its hands off levers that might be able to direct an economy, those hands aren't idle. And instead, we have governments intent on legislating like crazy to push people into regulated worlds of competition. And so all the measures that I've spoken about so far require very heavy government intervention. So privatising energy, for example, requires the creation through law of a very complex energy market where sellers and buyers are forced to bid at regular intervals for the price of electricity, with energy market regulators monitoring the performance of the government-created system. My point is, this isn't some kind of state of nature, the natural market that was envisaged sort of hundreds of years ago. It takes work to force reality into the structures of the market, and government is about making that happen. So government won't use its power to make sure everyone has electricity, but it will make sure there's an electricity market. And these pose really significant questions for how we deal with things like climate change. But I want to suggest that here lies a fundamental political weakness of economic rationalism, which I think Joe Hockey and Tony Abbott are finding out as they run up against the limits of what Australian people think is right and proper. Life starts in common, and it has to be forced apart into separate individualised parcels. And as much as we're forced to compete, increasingly now we're reliant on and immersed in social and technological networks that connect us. The idea of not being connected and not being in common with someone else is now inconceivable. Inconceivable. And back to my starting point, overshadowing every question in retail politics, we're now faced with a crisis of global warming, which I think is a crisis of the commons par excellence, and which can only be dealt with by large-scale transformations in energy, transport and industry. And in short, it's the project of economic rationalism requires constant division and separation from above, whereas the project of the commons requires reconnection from below. And I think this is the space of the Greens and for government in our future. And just a little bit of context. The Greens took root in Australia in the 1970s, and as economic rationalism was taking root on one side, we as the Greens began a project that was from its start based on connection and connection between people. Connection between people and the planet, and connection between people and each other. And having seen firsthand the tragedy of the commons that drove air pollution and dams and logging and plundering, the Greens project from its inception placed shared knowledge at the forefront. The forerunners of the Greens, the United Tasmanian Group, had a new ethic that spoke of the need for new institutions to allow communal development and economic democracy. While the opening words of the Greens Charter recognised the commons divided, and let me just read them to you. The opening words of our Greens Charter are, "We live at a crucial time in history. Never before have we had so many answers to the problems that have dogged our developing world. Solutions now exist that could greatly decrease the poverty, hunger and ill health of our fellow humans, and we now have technologies to reduce and repair much of the ecological damage to our planet." And that is ultimately a recommitment to modernity, to human creativity and intelligence, and to our ability to shape our future. And I noticed as I was reading on in preparation for this that I'd suspect that we're probably the only party to inscribe the position of future generations in our founding document. Our charter goes on to read that we seek to avoid parochialism and to cultivate a global ecological consciousness and a long-term perspective in order to safeguard the interests of both existing and future generations and non-human species. And when, you know, one of the big privileges of my life is to be in Parliament at the same time as Bob Brown, and whenever we reached a point where we were being required to make a thorny decision, his guidance to us was, well, I want you to think seven generations ahead and think what will they think in seven generations about the decisions that we're making today. But over the decades of us, ahead of us now, I think turning this promise of the commons into politics involves government. And it involves government being willing to plan for the future, seeing its role as a midwife of a clean energy society and a more equal society. So let me now move into the last part of my talk by suggesting what I think a future-focused government would do. I think one of the first things, point number one, that a future-focused government would do would be to reassert the public's right to determine what happens with Australia's shared resources, whether they be minerals and fossil fuels or schools and knowledges. I think there's no way, to elaborate on this first point, there's no way that we can transition to a clean economy without government guidance in these matters. And I stress that this doesn't necessarily mean government ownership or nationalisation, but it must mean the assertion of the public's right to safeguard parts of our Commonwealth for the future and to direct it to areas deemed to be national priorities. Australia's success in the 21st century will depend on us being a country with a highly educated public and workforce and with something to sell the rest of the world other than coal. And recent experience, though, and I'm thinking here about the attempt to have a public discussion about a mining tax or the decline in funding for science, confirms for me that without a plan led by government, we're not going to grow these areas of our society and nor will we retain a public benefit for them. I think we have a lot to learn from countries that have saved the proceeds of their mineral wealth, just as we do from our trading partners who spend double what we do on R&D. We are now in a situation where we are spending collectively, adding public and private expenditure together, the lowest on science, research and innovation in this country since we started keeping records in the late 70s. Like, we are now spending 2.2% of our GDP on combined public and private on science and science, research and innovation. Many of our trading partners are upwards of 4 or 5, and the trend is downwards. The trend is downwards, and that's something we must turn around. So I think in a policy sense, a future-focused government would redirect unfair and unaffordable subsidies away from industries and people that don't need them and towards the ones that do. And so I would argue we should be taking excessive subsidies for fossil fuels and resources, and indeed some subsidies that exist for superannuation and the banks, and I'd be redirecting those billions into science, R&D, education, health and medical technologies, ICT, construction of affordable housing, healthcare, the services sector. We as the Greens have developed costed proposals to do this, and it turns out you can do it without increasing personal income tax. It ultimately becomes a question of priority rather than necessarily imposing new taxes on wage earners. Second point, I think a future government-focused government would do would have a renewed assault on the gap between rich and poor by making inequality a central political question again. Thirdly, future-focused government should give people greater control over their working lives by stopping the shifting of risk and insecurity onto workers and everyday citizens. And government needs to make flexibility a genuine two-way street, so allowing people to have greater individual and collective control over their working hours and arrangements. And again, this is a classic situation where I think we've got to put ourselves in the shoes of someone who's grown up under a highly casualised labour market, perhaps where they're rolling from contract to contract, accepting that that works for some people, but for many it doesn't. And so what is the solution to that? The solution to that probably isn't to regulate with a one-size-fits-all approach, but the solution has to be to give people greater control, including legal control, over their hours and their conditions of work. Fourthly, governments should stop forcing people into artificially divided and disconnected forms of life and instead promote measures that reconnect communities, people and the planet. There's a political scientist and thinker in the United States who reminds us that the two-party system encourages people to choose between outdated notions of mum and dad. One party supposedly looks after you and the other one is strict and supposedly there to protect you. I want to suggest that both are paternalistic, and a return here instead to the idea of the midwife state, or some have even called it the partner state. Government here fosters connections, creates the conditions for human creativity to flourish, and preserves the conditions of life. I met yesterday a young guy who's working out of Melbourne University, and he's in one of their great innovation labs that they've got set up. And he, as many people will know, one of the potential next breakthroughs in energy is around domestic storage and batteries that people will be able to have in their homes. Tesla's coming out with a Powerwall, but there's things that you can buy in Australia off the shelf at the moment for about $12,000 that'll do for most houses, and it has the potential to significantly disrupt the operation of the grid and poses some serious questions about how we're going to fund the grid, etc., etc. This guy's worked out that you can that most of the batteries that are in our iPhones or our laptops or potentially going to be used in electric cars tend to get replaced well before the batteries actually run out. We replace a battery in the electric car, for example, because there's a difference between if the car can do 150 kilometre range versus being able to do 100 kilometre range. People will start getting a bit more anxious if a battery can only do 100 k's. So there's this high turnover of replacement of things like batteries, and it's the same with laptops as well. Where they're high performance devices, and so they need the battery to be performing at a peak level, and so people will replace them when they stop, but there's still life left in the batteries. He's working out this amazing technology that is essentially a magic box, as he called it, that you'll be able to plug in discarded batteries into, plug in a series of them, so put in a couple of car batteries and a few old laptop batteries into a box that you'll keep in your house, and it will run, because most of those batteries are still 80% efficient. He said he went to a local e-waste place and they did some tests on all the discarded batteries in the e-waste places, and most of them are all still 80% efficient, and they just don't perform the needs of the device anymore. So they're going around collecting them all up and going to pop them into this magic box that will basically be able to find the bits of the battery that are still usable through their software, and that will serve as the battery for your solar power, and it'll come at a fraction of the cost of the existing batteries, because basically you don't have to manufacture the battery in the first place. You just have to go and pick up what other people have already thrown out. And he's struggling to find any assistance from government in Australia to make that idea work here. And so they're looking at going overseas. And this story is being repeated. I hear it in this field. I hear it in the health and medical research field, where people say, I can't keep going from year to year without knowing whether my project's going to be funded. But if I go to the States or I go to the UK, they'll guarantee me 5 years' worth, so I'm going to pack up and go over there. In my vision, I think the midwife states that the midwife state that will usher in the clean economy is there to support and nurture amazing human creativity like we're witnessing right here on our doorstep, but we're at risk of losing. And the government building this capacity won't just, I think, reconnecting people in this way. Will be critical not just for finding solutions to the climate challenge, but also to ensuring that the form of society that exists in a challenged world is one that prioritises democracy. And this is where I sometimes get a little bit worried, because, as I said earlier, unless Australia becomes a zero pollution society by mid-century at the latest, as part of global action, we should expect a world of more frequent bushfires, worse cyclones, and Ross Garnaut predicts agricultural collapse in parts of the Murray-Darling Basin by the end of the century. Now, one of the things that worries me is that in the absence of a common project with democracy and sustainability at its core, we don't just face the collapse of the biosphere. I fear a slide into a form of authoritarianism and a much meaner and more insular Australia, where we lose the outward focus that at least we have in part at the moment. Fifth thing that I think the future-focused government should do is it needs a new understanding of productivity, one that recognises that survival in the 21st century will be based on connected, clean and strong communities, and not ever diminishing attempts to force more out of people in the workplace. I think we have to accept that so much of productivity now takes place on the outside. It's the investments in education. It's a good set of public transport that is able to move people around and ensure the cities are unclogged. It's people feeling connected to their communities that drive productivity as much as what happens inside the workplace. And I've given one reason as to why I think Tony Abbott and Joe Hockey's musings on the relationship between government borrowing and the future are wrong, but I think there's another more strictly financial one. As writer Russell Marx points out, now is precisely the time to think about borrowing to fund infrastructure for the future. And he quotes, and he says, and I quote, when the bond rate is very low, as it is now, 10-year bond rate's an all-time low of 2.55%, the government can borrow money and repay bondholders at that rate of interest for the next decade. By definition, if whatever project or investment the government spends that borrowed money on generates a return of greater than the bond rate, the debt is a very, very good idea. And it's much better to borrow now to fund an infrastructure project that's predicted to generate high returns, like a new hospital or a rail extension or a justice reinvestment scheme to reduce prison spending, than to avoid borrowing and therefore leave that project to a future government that will probably need to borrow at a higher bond rate. So I think the emphasis that the government puts on not leaving legacies for future generations, just in the strictly financial sense, can be turned on its head. Like, if now is as good a time as any to borrow, then surely we should, within our means, we should be doing it, provided there's a productive piece of investment and infrastructure there, an asset waiting for it at the end of it. May never be a better time to build high-speed rail on the East Coast, for example, but it requires government thinking differently about debt in the future. Sixthly and lastly, over-determining everything, active government support for our biosphere and a new clean economy needs a nation-building plan to have Australia running on renewable energy within a decade or two. This time around, I'm just reminded of some of the things that we said before the recorder was turned on about the significance and the importance of thinking about the future. I think this time around, compared with times that governments have tried to do it previously, a government plan for the future is important not because it should be imposed from above, but rather because it's the very act of thinking about how things concretely could be different that holds the door ajar for us and offers us a way out. I think the laying out of an emergency plan to deal with climate action by government is less a Stalinist vision of a controlled society and more a map guiding a path to safety. Indeed, having a plan for achievable actions might once have been thought of by some progressives as too pragmatic and insufficiently utopian, but now, ironically, the hegemony of economic rationalism casts a plan as impossible, if not dangerous. And the writer and columnist George Monbiot puts it well when he says, when you warn people about the dangers of climate change, they call you a saint. When you explain what needs to be done to stop it, they call you a communist. But I think, in truth, the slow decline of old-style social democracy has opened up a new space in the political imaginary. A government plan of possible or concrete action, of sending someone to the moon, or of having a world solely powered by renewable energy in a decade, functions itself as a reminder that a different world is possible, and this might make people get interested in politics again. And in fact, if this time around, I want to suggest a plan will absolutely not work if government thinks its only role is to decide on and then enforce a plan on its citizenry. Instead, the midwife state has to begin by recognising, as I said before, that so much of Australia's productivity, of the creation of value in economic as well as other sense, no longer takes place only within the narrow factory of office walls, but out in the open, in connection between members of an educated population. I think what remains for us is to reclaim this as a new common space of humanity. So why not, for example, an open source collective plan to create and own a new renewable energy infrastructure where the details of the plan are not set from the beginning by government, but where collective development is itself an integral part of the project? Why not the generation of multiple local electricity plants owned and run by streets and neighbourhood if that's the most efficient thing to do? Maybe a national renewable energy network of the scale of the broadband plan, a snowy hydro for the 21st century. And I think it's important to end by never forgetting the inspirational potential of a government plan for the future. One writer, Jodie Dean, reminds us that, in her words, men walked on the moon because there was a collective commitment to a common project, a project for the good, not just of engineers and patent holders, not just for a political party or ideology, and not just for the nationalist aspirations of a particular nation. The Apollo project boldly predicted the we of a common humanity aspiring to break the bonds of particularity and reach beyond our imaginations. And I think here we're talking about an Apollo project for the 21st century. But for that even to get off the ground, I think we have to ditch the platitudes of economic rationalism and third wave social democracy that told us that the government's role was only to steer the ship and not to row. What is the role of government for our future? I think we should look less to Stalin and more to Kennedy as we unashamedly say, think long term and stop treating plan as just another four-letter word.